Blog Talk Radio.
And now, broadcasting from the banks of the historic Vermilion River, amidst the rolling prairie, cornfields, and unsightly wind farms of central Illinois, it's the Rhino Hour of Power, with your host, Rick Moran, like Diogenes without a lantern.
Welcome. Click, click, click. There you go. To the Rhino Hour of Power. I'm your host, Rick Moran. And joining me in a couple of seconds will be our good friend from the American Thinker, the lovable, the laughable, J.R. Dunn. J.R., how's it going, buddy?
Howdy. This is the Moran Show, right?
It's the Rhino Hour of Power.
Rhino Hour of Power,
that's
right.
The show. I took my name off the show in self-defense.
good idea. Good thinking.
We'll be joined in a little while by Bridget Johnson. With Bridget, you'll have to excuse
from,
me. I am Bridget Johnson from PJ Media,
the
Washington
Media,
editor there. Yeah, and I got to tell you, it's been a hell of a day, JR. I don't know about you, it's been a hell of a day.
Well, what happened?
Well, just busy. You know, busy in the morning with the American Thinker, and then busy in the afternoon with PJ Media.
Okay.
And I don't get no time for myself. You don't mind if I whine a bit, do you? I so rarely whine, you know.
Not according to AT readers, but anyway, take the rest of the hour off. I'll take over.
God, I lose every single listener I got, all 12 of them. No, I'm just kidding. Well, here's a problem for us, JR. Before I get Bridget on here, we'll talk about the Clinton emails, talk about the letter to Iran by Republicans. Maybe we can get a little bit into the Oklahoma University controversy over a racist chant. Or whatever it was. I'm not quite sure it was. Well, it's racist to call somebody the N-word, but, you know, was it, you know, hateful? I don't know. Certainly,
well,
didn't
it's pretty nasty.
To get
they were talking about lynching, so that's way over the line.
Yeah. Oh, I'm not saying anything except you shouldn't expel somebody for freedom of speech because of freedom of speech. Anyway, we'll get into that. In the meantime, we're going to have a vote soon. I don't know when. The government is going to run out of money in about 5 days. The debt limit is going to have to be raised.
Not. We've been through this so many times. We know for sure that it's just not going to happen, one way or another. Usually by the Republicans caving, the spigots could turn on again.
Well, yes, but the point being, it's become a big Megillah.
Yeah, it's
every single time we raise the debt. Of course it is, because the Republicans will never, you know, the Republicans will always snatch defeat from the jaws of victory.
They're the responsible party. The Democrats know this. The Democrats know they can run out and fling themselves in front of the railroad tracks just as the trains come in, and the Republicans are going to come out and drag them out. That's what this comes down to. It's just over and over and over again.
It's just
tiresome.
It just seems to me, but there are people threatening to say, well, we're not going to vote unless we do this, that, and everything else. You know, they should have thought about that before they voted the money. I mean, they voted to spend the money.
And they voted.
Now they're not going to vote to raise the debt limit. I mean, it's crazy.
That's one way of looking at it. But the fact is, it's turned into something like a bullfight in which there's no bull, but just a guy running around with his fingers pointed out like they're horns. Those are the Democrats, all right. And the Republicans are the guys that is standing there waving the cape. and it's completely bogus, and everybody knows it's bogus, but everybody runs around screeching at the top of their lungs, acting like it's an incredible crisis, like, you know, the sky is going to fall, the earth will be rendered in twain if the U.S. budget is not passed. I mean, come on. It's totally fake. It's totally pantomime, and it's just sickening. It's really long overdue that somebody actually got up and said this, rather than, you know, going into this tick tick tick. The clock is ticking. Will they pass the bill before midnight? Oh, yeah, okay. here comes Willis jumping into the well of the Senate, waving a machine gun. You know, I mean, come on.
Yeah. Really. Okay. Get your point there, JR. Get your point. So we should pass a bill then eliminating this vote for the debt ceiling, right? It should just go up automatically. Whatever Congress passes, as you know, whatever Congress funds in the government, it should be paid for, and this nonsense about the debt limit should be gone, right?
I would say that's one solution. I myself would prefer something like a boycott. I would just get up and call it and walk out. If I were running the House or the Senate, but of course that's not going to happen.
Well, you never know. You don't have to be a congressman to be Speaker of the House. You know. We can make you Speaker of the House.
Well, yeah, and that's what I do. That's what I do. I get up and walk out, and everybody out there walk out with me, just to prove how stupid it is, just to demonstrate how bogus it is from the get go. That would cause a few strokes, I would think.
Oh, sure.
But of course, they're part of the establishment, and they got to play the game, so it's not going to happen.
Yeah, it seems like everything in Washington just is tailored to distract us. From stuff like, I don't know, unimportant stuff like Islamic State, the economy.
Yeah. Well, you know better than I do.
I know.
It's definitely the case here. It's definitely the case with this budget stuff. And of course, the media plays right along with it. These guys know better. These guys have been out there for 20, 30 years covering this stuff, and they know exactly what the facts are. But they play along with it. Because it brings in listeners, it brings in viewers, it sells papers.
Yeah, it's bogus for sure. Here's another subject for you, and you're a lawyer, so this is kind of right up your alley. The Obamacare case.
Me? I'm not a lawyer.
Burrito.
I'm a lawyer.
I thought you were a lawyer.
No.
Oh. Okay.
No, I just talk about trash about the law. I'm not a lawyer, but I play one on TV.
Oh, okay. The Republicans now are wringing their hands because they're going to get their wish. Obamacare might blow up. This is great. I mean, it's so typical.
They got to do a little work now.
Yeah, well, the Burwell case that's going to be heard by the Supreme Court will destroy subsidies if John Roberts doesn't lose his head and listen to a bunch of liberals saying it'll destroy the Supreme Court, too, which is what they do with the Obamacare mandate, if you recall.
Uh-huh.
So if they pass this, it'll be the end of the Supreme Court. So hopefully Mr. Roberts will keep his nerve and vote with the majority, and Obamacare subsidies will be kaputnik. The Republicans, however, are saying, that's all right. We got a replacement ready to go. Here we go. 5 million people aren't going to lose their insurance. Only 3 million people are going to lose their insurance.
Well, considering the fact that, 15 million people have already lost their insurance, that's trivia. That's a drop in a bucket.
Well, no, not that many. As a matter of fact, the net gain is about 7-8 million, I think, yeah. If 5 million people, 6 million people who've lost their insurance, thanks to the president's lie that you can keep your insurance if you like it.
Most of these people are not going to lose their insurance. Number one, because I know some people who have been involved in this from the consumer end, and they're on Medicare, What they've done is they this has nothing to do with Obamacare directly. It's Medicare.
Medicaid.
Yeah. Well, in some cases it's Medicaid, in some cases it is Medicare.
Yeah, this will not affect
Medicaid has been expanded, but Medicare is also picking up the slack too. Check into it; you'll find out this is true.
Who's getting Medicare that wasn't getting it earlier? These people are not on Obamacare.
These people are not on Obamacare,
but they're not on Medicare either.
All right, so
they
let that go. They're on Medicaid, all right. Right?
Yes, and they're about 8 million people who are taking advantage of the expanded Medicaid, and those people are not going to lose anything because
those people are not going to lose anything.
Court
right.
case has nothing to do with the Medicaid expansion.
Exactly. So we're not talking about any sort of universal crisis.
There's 5 or 6 million people who are getting subsidies through Obamacare, the healthcare.gov exchange, not the states. People get these subsidies through the states are all right. They're just fine. But people who get subsidies through the healthcare.gov website are going to lose those subsidies. Now, my question to you is, since those subsidies are based on people who are making 144% of the poverty level, some of those people can afford insurance without the subsidy.
Absolutely.
That's been the entire argument all along.
And we're supposed to just let this go and, you know, start thinking of some guy living in a cardboard box on the corner who doesn't have insurance, and that's all of them. That's the entire 3 or 4 million. Okay, and this is nonsense. The whole point with Obamacare is it has nothing to do with healthcare. It has to do it's a transfer program designed to transfer wealth from a certain level of middle class taxpayers to everybody else. That's what it is. And what this argument reminds me of more than anything else is the welfare reform of the Clinton era that Clinton was forced into by the Republican Congress. Now, what we heard about at the time was, oh, there are millions of people forced out in the streets, this, that, another thing. And it didn't turn out to be millions of people. It didn't even turn out to be thousands. They were forming welfare, and it was probably the smoothest thing that ever came out of Washington in the last 60 years.
I think you're right, because if people were going to lose their welfare checks, they went out and got a job.
If they weren't ripping off the system in the first place, which is, of course, what people like Ronald Reagan had been arguing for years, that for a large part, welfare was a scam. And this did turn out to be a case. There was no mass tidal wave of people starving and lying around in the streets and every other, being forced out of their homes and every other damn thing. And it's very likely, I suspect, it's the same thing because it's the same process, Rick. Let's face it. It's the exact same bureaucratic and social process at work here. I suspect it's the same thing with this Obamacare thing. So this entire thing about, you know, millions of people are, you know, their chemotherapy is going to be called off and they're just going to drop dead right on the spot and it's all going to be the Republicans. There's going to be elephant tracks all over the place. That's how you can tell. And it's another load of BS is what it comes down to.
Yeah, I'm not sure that there are going to be people slipping through the cracks, but that's inevitable.
But there always is. There are people slipping through the cracks now.
Yeah.
So that's not a legitimate argument, I don't think.
I don't get a subsidy.
I don't get a subsidy either. They want me to pay. I don't even know how much yet. They want me to pay that next month.
I'm paid $526 a month. $526 a month. I'm paying for insurance.
That's
$120 more
money
than I used to pay. Yeah, it's
even in this day and age, that is big money.
Well, yeah, especially when, you know, I was barely, you know, living hand to mouth before I had to pay $526.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it's neither here nor there. I just wonder what you think the outcome is going to be. The judge in that case renewed the injunction against, I'm thinking of immigration. The sentiment on among court watchers appears to be that there's a good chance it can be overturned if the court can be convinced that there won't be that much disruption and chaos.
Right. I understand that that's a problem with Kennedy, because Kennedy tends to get sentimental about this kind of stuff.
Yes.
We know that. That was the story with abortion. He flipped on abortion because he got sentimental.
A judge can
and wherever Kennedy goes, Roberts is going to go.
Yeah, we'll have to see about that.
I'm keeping my fingers crossed. But after the last Obamacare decision, which was just so stratospherically bizarre, it was like a Rube Goldberg machine. I don't know if most people would even recognize the reference, but it's like a Rube Goldberg machine, and it was just so absurd that. If they could come out and say, well, we've decided to keep Obamacare because the lizard people from Tau Ceti flew over the Supreme Court in a flying saucer and told us that. And I would think to myself, well, yeah, that makes about as much sense as the last decision. So, yeah, let's go with it.
Sure, absolutely.
But, of course, if they do make that decision, what they're saying is we don't have to go by law anymore. We can read any law the way we want, because the law reads flat out only the states. You cannot have federal subsidies. Period. Paragraph. All right. So we come out with a law that says we're going to disallow all Arab terrorists from blowing up bridges in the United States, and immediately people start blowing up bridges, and we say, well, that's not what the law meant.
Yeah,
it's not what it meant. You know. They could say anything they want now, and you do not want to give Congress the power to run, or the bureaucracy, which is what it is in this case. It's the federal bureaucracy that's giving out these subsidies. You do not want them to give the power to start interpreting laws the way they want. Because
well, that's what they've been doing. Look at that's the IRS for you right there. Let's bring on Bridget Johnson.
Good point.
Let's bring on Bridget Johnson, who's been waiting patiently as usual. Hi, Bridget. How's it going?
It's going. How you guys doing?
Well, JR is regaling us with his usual patter.
My insight.
Conversation.
Insight.
Yeah. I couldn't help wondering. How about you, Bridget? Do you have a private email server in your house?
I don't. In fact, when I was actually working at the Rocky Mountain News, my home modem got hacked. So I had thought that my computer got hacked for some reason. But then I even brought in, an e-crimes detective from the Denver police, because they were leaving, threatening messages. And we tracked it down to they hacked the modem. So,
oh, dear. Who did it? Who did you get? Who could get angry at you to send...
Well, let me see. Iran, China, Venezuela.
I got one. Hillary Clinton.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Oh, speaking of Hillary, let's get on this because this is an inside the Beltway story, isn't it, Bridget? It's not going to play in the hinterland. It's not going to be really a part of the 2016 conversation, but it is having an effect. In internal Democratic politics, and it's certainly having an effect in the way the press is portraying Hillary Clinton. But what about this email scandal of Mrs. Clinton? What do you make of it?
Well, okay, first, this is what I'm hearing from Democrats, is they're actually not liking the prospect of months of Hillary acting like she's on the defensive, giving, long defensive diatribes, because that's not what they want their next candidate to be about. So I think that they're kind of scared at this point because they see this scandal, which is probably going to go to court in terms of Gowdy and other House Republicans trying to access the server that she wants to keep private for the purpose of the Benghazi investigation. So this will probably drag out for months more. It's going to swallow a lot of Hillary's campaign air, especially since she hasn't made the announcement yet. When is there going to be a time for her to make the announcement that won't get overshadowed by this? And how much dirt will there be before she gets around to making an announcement?
Yeah. She said there were 60,000 emails sent during her tenure as Secretary of State. And she said she's given 30,000 of them to the State Department, but the other 30,000 are off limits because they're personal.
They're about yoga.
Now, how long? Yeah, now let's see. She was about 4.5 years as Secretary of State. Just a rough, back of the envelope type calculation here. She'd be sending out about 30 emails a day. Personal emails. You have to wonder when she got any work done, you know. This is bogus. And not only that, she may have destroyed thousands of emails, she says, although she contradicted herself a little bit later. What do you make of this, Solomonic decision to have the emails and give half to the American people and keep half to herself?
Solomonic, I like it.
I worked for hours on that one. I worked for hours on that one.
when she said at the press conference something about, those are, private conversations between me and my husband, they're going to stay private. The look on her face was just kind of like I could just see, TMZ salivating, trying to figure out how they get their hands on those emails. Because she just had this kind of constipated look when she said, conversations between me and Bill, now we really want to see what they are. But the minute she started talking about how, it was Chelsea wedding planning, it was yoga, instantly this Twitter account popped up, Yoga by Hillary. It's something where I don't think the press conference did her too many favors.
To say the least.
Because, first of all, the amount of press there was hilarious. They were just, basically falling off the railings, overhead there. And it was kind of weird to hold it at the UN. It was weird to have her handler there, calling on a few people, calling on the Turkish press first, but even the Turkish press and then to the emails. and then, at the end, somebody was asking a question. They yanked her off. So it was. She basically left too many things open ended. So I'm not sure it's something where, she went in trying to kind of tidily wrap up the scandal and wrap up the loose ends and laugh about it and say that it's a non scandal. I should have had an extra BlackBerry, this and that. Yeah, it was just too open-ended. So Congress is going to have fun with it, and they are having fun with it.
Well, yes, this kind of fits in with the...
JR, will it reach the level of a feeding frenzy? Is it, let's pretend that this was Chris Christie.
Right, exactly.
Well, months and months and months of speculative analysis about what's in those emails. A feeding frenzy. Will it reach that level, or will it kind of die off?
That's exactly what it's going to do, because this fits into to the two major narratives about the Clintons. One, they're beyond the law. They do whatever they damn well please. They make the rules, not anybody else, and they decide which ones they're going to follow. And two, Hillary can't be trusted. She is a 24-hour a day, 7 days a week, 360 days, 65 days a year liar. And prevaricator who has never been involved in anything that she's told the truth about. So definitely it is going to have that it's going to boom, particularly if the Republicans in Congress get in on it, which is a question in and of itself. We find out that Trey Gowdy had this information for 6 months and did nothing with it. But let's face it, they're afraid of the Clintons still to this day.
Well, wouldn't you be when anybody who crosses them just about gets squashed? They are modern-day godfathers,
That's true. That's true. But you can't run a country by kowtowing to godfathers. Eventually, they make an error and they can be taken down. I'm hoping that this is at least an opening to that level of error. Yeah. Maybe not. Maybe she'll be able to squeeze her way out of it the way she squeezed out of everything before. The cattle futures, the Watergate firing, this, that, another thing. The entire massive list of corruption going back between the two of them for 40, even 50, nearly 50 years. Maybe.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think it seems to me that the press is sick of them, too, particularly the fact that they all had to wait for 3 hours while the UN's one single press officer processed all of their paperwork before they could get in. They couldn't have been happy about that.
No.
I saw a piece in Tablet magazine, too. They were suggesting that the Obamas godfathered the Clintons on this. were the ones feeding the information to the press and stoking them up and getting them riled up about it.
Well, there is still animosity, especially on the part of the Clintons toward Obama, and Obama knows it, and he doesn't like it. And you know, of course, it goes all the way back to the Massachusetts endorsement of Ted Kennedy for Obama during the primaries.
Mm-hmm.
Where Clinton thought he had Ted Kennedy in the bag, and something happened in a matter of 48 hours. Kennedy had done an about face and was supporting Obama, and Clinton thought that was dirty pool, and has not forgiven him since. Which makes Bill Clinton an interesting figure in this upcoming campaign. I predict he is going to maintain a very low profile. Very low.
Well, he has to, doesn't
he? Sure, he doesn't want to remind people of the Clinton Foundation, which has been taking money hand over foot from some of the worst governments in the world,
uh-huh.
and some of the worst people in the world. I predict he would be maintaining a very low profile in the upcoming campaign. And that includes the general election campaign. I mean, he'll come in, he'll give us barn burners of a speech to the convention. He might make some major speeches along the way. Other than that, you know, he'll be the dutiful spouse hanging around in the background, looking adoringly at his wife as she speaks. That'll be a switch, won't it, Bridget?
But can he bring that off? Is it possible for Bill Clinton to bring that off? I have
with
my
that
doubts.
Kind of ego, you wonder. Yeah, you have to wonder with that kind of ego.
So, yeah. Demure Bill Clinton.
Yeah, I know. The house husband Bill Clinton. Sure.
Well,
I think so. You know, the Obama administration, though, they just might have been in a godfathering mood. You know, with what they did to Menendez this past week. It just kind of, you know, let's hit the.
That's a question on everybody's mind. Is this a campaign? I think the question is still up in the air. People have been pretty skeptical about it, but I don't think anything like this happens on this level with both Menendez and Clinton one after the other without there being some very serious thinking in the Oval Office.
Yeah.
Well, there's certainly the leak from the Department of Justice. To CNN on the pending Menendez prosecution can be construed as suspicious. But having said that, there are legitimate reasons why they have to do this now, and that is basically has to do with the statute of limitations on some of the charges, because they go all the way back to 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these charges of influence peddling and pay for play.
But how long were they sitting
this,
on the charges till they decided they were politically useful?
I think
evidently the trial of the doctor did not conclude until the fall of last year, as I recall. So they couldn't really do much until they had the doctor set up for immunity, or not immunity, but you know, for a sentencing deal.
And then
the FBI and the prosecutors, the federal prosecutors, were able to get at him. These things take time anyway. This is a very complicated case having to do with, the senator's actions to benefit the doctor's business interests in both here and overseas in Costa Rica and Honduras. And it also has to do with the doctor's gifts and payments of cash, and that's very hard to trace too. So, I want to believe, like everybody else, that this is a payback for Menendez's support, or I'm sorry, opposition to the president's Iran policy and his opposition to the Cuban policy. But, you know, there are such things as coincidences in history, and the evidence is going to have to be a lot more solid than just outcomes, as it is now.
Right, but it's just after the Cuban war, on one hand, and on the other hand, it's just before the Iran agreement talks climax. So that to me adds a little bit shadow to the picture.
Right, and
yes,
Rick, you insisted that I was Ron and Alberto Niesman, so I remember that.
I didn't. No, I said you were jumping to conclusions. I didn't say you were wrong. I said you were jumping to conclusions.
Two days
after the assassination, you were. So I don't know.
Well, let's look at it this way. The Goldfinger's rule is: number one is bad luck. Number two is coincidence. We're still on number two. Number three will be enemy action.
Conspiracy.
Right.
Yeah, I've been saying for months, because I've just seen this build up with Menendez, that, you know, thinking that if something comes up against him, I would think first is the White House who's behind it, and that's just because of the long running, shall I say, statements coming out of the White House, different reactions to what Menendez is doing, Menendez's reaction to the White House, and just this growing huge tension between the two. And you know, it's coming to a head because the March 25th deadline is coming up. Menendez is ready. He's ready to take it to the floor. And even with the whole, fury from some Democrats over this GOP letter to the Ayatollahs, even Harry Reid admitted today that it will not diminish Democratic support for the Corker-Menendez bill, which is basically what the letter was asking for, which was for congressional approval for any nuclear deal with Iran.
Yeah. And I think it'll pass, and Obama will veto it, and then we'll have a constitutional crisis. Well, anyway.
It could be veto-proof.
I don't know. There are 12 Democratic senators. There might be 10.
Yeah, you've got all the moderates. You got Schumer. You got Menendez. You've got. I was whip counting it.
It's close.
They look like they're
it's
there.
Close.
I'll say that.
Yeah. I had a point to make, and it slipped my mind because Bridget brutally.
It was pretty rough, yeah.
Brutal attack on this.
I'm your witness on that one, Rick.
At any rate, let's move on to that letter because this is, I can't believe the reaction to it.
The reaction is completely asinine.
Purer than the driven snow Democrats, we would never interfere in the foreign policy of the president. We would never do anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, is ridiculous. They were sending signals all during the Iraq war that they were going to cut off funding. I mean,
absolutely.
What do you think that does to the enemy, you know?
They're as much as responsible to the...
They're
as much responsible for the current situation in Iraq as anybody else. You know, everybody throughout the media, you see people running back and forth saying, "Oh, it's George W. Bush. It's poor Barack Obama. It just dumped in his lap," and every other sort of thing. No, it was the Democratic Congress who built up to this as you said, all throughout the entire war.
And most of them who voted for the war. So you know,
yes, including Obama himself, who was involved in it up to his neck.
Well, at any rate, so the Republicans send this letter to the Ayatollahs, and it tells them, look, according to our Constitution, any agreement that the president reaches with you guys is going to have to be approved by the Senate, because that's the way our Constitution works. And I got news for you guys over there in the little in the robes and the shadows and everything else. We ain't going to approve it. You need 67 votes. If he has 40 votes for approval of the of an Iran deal, I would be shocked. That leaves him 27 short, Bridget. Which is why he doesn't want to bring any agreement to the Congress.
Which
of course,
means
that in 2017, we could, if it's a Republican president, or even Hillary, if she didn't like the deal.
Which means it's not an agreement. Here he's undercut the constitutional system through his phone and his pen. Now he's undercutting the concept of foreign relations constitutionally through this misbegotten deal with the Iranians. I mean, and people are criticizing the Republicans for defying this. We want to see it. We want to see it crash. We don't want to see this agreement going with the Iranians. Now, Noni Darwish had a very interesting piece today on AT, in which he pointed out that this agreement, as you know, we don't know exactly what's in it yet. Needless to say, but from what it seems, it's an agreement that is based on Sharia law. They've actually managed to jerk Barack Obama around to make an Islamic deal with them. For instance, they aren't allowed to negotiate with an infidel to come up with a treaty. They aren't allowed to negotiate treaties. They can negotiate truce agreements, but not treaties. And this is what they've negotiated. They've negotiated a truce agreement, and they can negotiate a truce agreement up to the limit of 10 years. And just by coincidence, this agreement is for 10 years. What Obama has done is managed to twist himself into a pretzel in order to enable the Ayatollahs to jerk him around and get the exact agreement they want that it not only is in their favor, but is perfectly suitable for Islamic law. And it's something that, of course, nobody understands. The media does not mention it. Even Congress doesn't grasp it.
Well, if we want an idea of how Iran will approach any agreement they make with us on this, all we have to do is look at the interim agreement that was signed last year, where we specifically prohibited Iran from upgrading their centrifuge machines to a much more efficient, a much faster spinning machine. And they went ahead and did it anyway.
They went ahead and did it, sure.
They interpret things the way they want to. They say, okay, well, you can look at it that way. That's fine. We'll let you do that. But this is what we think it means, and we're gonna do what we think it means.
It's
and we had a little bit of that, JR, we had a little bit of that with the Soviet Union and SALT treaties, if you recall.
Yeah, it's not integral.
Nothing
to,
like
that's
this.
Not really integral to Soviet culture. This is integral to Islamic culture. It's takaya. It's okay to lie to an infidel under any circumstances. And that's what they're doing.
What's infuriating about the administration on this, though, is that they're just assuming that everything that the Iranians say, whether in Iranian media or on social media, is just for public consumption at home, and that must all be lies. You know, like
right.
When the Ayatollah comes out and tweets that, yeah, let's go destroy Israel today, or even like last week on Iran Press TV, they said that they will not even move forward in nuclear talks unless all sanctions are repealed. Hello, we're not hearing that from the administration here. But, you know, what reason do we actually have to doubt that this is what they're actually asking for at the negotiating table? And then also, you know, congressional Republicans and Democrats who are pro-Israel, anti-Iran, need to fight back against this stupid narrative from the White House that if we, you know, breathe the wrong way, if we look the wrong way, if we say the wrong thing, then we will drive Iran away from the negotiating table, and then we'll be the laughingstocks of the world, and everybody in the P5+1 will hate us. And just this really weird, almost kind of schoolyard argument. Because the only way that Iran walks away from this negotiating table is if they can't push the goalposts on the part of the U.S. anymore. That's something that was made very clear by Menendez. He said, you know, the administration keeps moving the goalposts on this, and they get more and more and more of what they want.
That's pretty much the same
correct.
Way that the Soviets played it back in the Cold War, and they were very successful at it.
Well, they were successful at the time. That SALT I treaty was abysmal. It was an awful treaty. You know, it limited us in ICBMs, for instance, but allowed the Soviets to build as fast as they possibly could every weapons, nuclear weapons system that they had.
Which
was,
they went and did all throughout the late 70s.
But now SALT II was not bad. SALT II actually put numerical limits on things, and that I thought was a pretty good treaty. And of course, the START treaty, I believe it was first negotiated by George Bush 41, was pretty good. Also, in that it also set numerical limits. That's what you need if you want parity. Anyway, this particular agreement, we've gone from. Iran prevented from enriching uranium to enriching uranium at 5% as fast as they possibly can with advanced centrifuges, about 8,000 of them they're talking about now, but that's about 20,000 or 25,000 of the old style centrifuges, which is ridiculous.
Yeah, and there's another point too. Is that 5% figure gets repeated constantly over and over again, media everywhere else. People act as if, you know, oh well, it's only 5%, and do you need to be up to 95%? That's not the way it works. When you're refining things like uranium, 5%, you're halfway there.
Yeah, more than halfway.
You can probably take
6 weeks. 6 weeks to enrich the uranium ore that they're using, that yellow cake stuff. 6 weeks to enrich that to 5%, about 2 weeks to enrich
it up to
95%.
And about 2 weeks to get up to 95%. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this is dishonest from the get-go.
And that's actually something that's stressed a lot during hearings by Brad Sherman from California. And he, you know, is continually stressing that, you know, that the enrichment numbers that we're being told, they're not as they appear, and also Iran can easily reboot and get to the percentage that they need really fast.
Absolutely.
So he's one of the Dems warning about breakout time.
And there's absolutely no negotiations going on as far as missile technology. They already have the Shabab 3.
Important point, yeah.
Which can reach Europe. But the Shabab 3A, which is the extra stage they want to put on the Shabab 3, could reach the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no negotiations whatsoever on ICBM technology, which is just, it's frightening.
It's stupid.
It's crazy.
This is exactly what we spent decades negotiating with the Soviets over in both SALT treaties and in the START treaties, was control of the number and accuracy of nuclear delivery systems. And the Iranians are allowed to go ahead with this just at their leisure. Now, of course, the difference there is that their missiles are probably very likely junk. They're derived from the North Korean models, which are not the best missiles in the world. I mean, one of the things that I always like about North Korea is one of their main missile models is called the No Dong, which really tells you just about all you need to know.
Yeah,
but still, it's a point that's too often overlooked.
Well, let's get back to the letter here because. Go ahead, Bridget. Go ahead.
I was going to say, everything that you need to know about the Iran negotiations can be summed up in John Kerry's statement last week about the anniversary of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, because he actually had the gall to say something about North Korea in there and about how they're successfully working with them to reduce their stockpile when, you know, what we just had that story come out saying that they'll have 100 weapons by 2020. So.
Jeez. Yeah. Well, you know, that's what you get when you put people who have, and I'm, you know, I don't criticize liberals like this often, but this is the new left, JR, don't you think? This is the new left of the 1960s, who if we all just disarmed, if we just all, you know, mothballed our weapons, turned our rifles and nukes into plowshares, the world would be great and everything would be fine, and we're the cause of all the problems in the world.
Yeah,
and if we disarm,
it's the mentality.
Everybody else is going to... It's crazy. It is absolutely nutso.
All the wars, all the aggression comes directly from the United States. Nobody in the entire world, all the way back to the Pleistocene era, has never done been as evil as the United States is, does. It's all the U.S. And of course, this is not only a dream world. It's insane. It's functionally insane because you cannot operate on that basis. And here, after 50 years of it being demonstrated over and over again in the 1970s in places like Cambodia, of course, if the United States got out of Vietnam, then there will be peace. I'm quoting Sidney Shanberg, by the way. I'm not making this up. There will be peace in throughout Southeast Asia immediately, except for the 3 million dead Cambodians, the 200,000 dead Vietnamese, and so forth and so on. And it goes all the way down the line here, Ethiopia, Nicaragua, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And today, what are we hearing? 50 years after this? The same damn thing. Oh, if the United States got out of the Mideast, then we'll make Iran our allies, and everything will be fine. Oh, sure it will. And you know we're saying this on top of the fact that the ISS is running around and degrading the thing to a level that even the medieval Muslims would have been appalled by, and this is a direct result of the policies coming from the Obama administration, which, Rick, as you point out, are derived from the New Left.
Yeah. Bridget, can we get back to this letter, because it is they say unprecedented. It's unprecedented in the sense that it's never happened before, but the kind of interference that the Republicans are engaged in has certainly been a part of our politics for 30, 40 years. But what about the politics of this letter? I think it was Reid today who said that that it makes the Democrats less likely to support a sanctions bill. Do you buy that?
Well, no. Reid actually told reporters outside of the policy luncheon today that it shouldn't make a difference. But he's actually trying to write it off. He was really pissed off about it on the floor yesterday, and he was ranting, you know, that it was un-American and blah blah blah, and Republicans are being evil. But then today, after he emerged from the closed-door meeting with other Democrats, he said that he doesn't think the letter means anything, and it won't support, it won't affect the bill. So maybe he got a talking to from some other Democrats behind closed doors there. So.
A lot can happen in 24 hours, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you think that's how it plays out? Do you think it doesn't matter? Is the two Democrats when the vote occurs on not only the Menendez bill but a sanctions bill that could come later this spring and be set to detonate on July 1st if the talks fail?
I think it would matter if Menendez had signed that letter, which he did not. If Corker would have signed that letter, which he did not. Corker was actually talking today about it, and they're not, you know, in a sort of, you know, condemnation sense that, you know, oh, you know, these guys were totally wrong. But Corker was saying that he believes that it was the White House that drove these lawmakers to do that, actually, because of their reluctance in letting Congress have any say in it. And remember, this is an administration where, you know, early on in the negotiations, hearing after hearing, they were saying, oh, yes, we're going to involve you, Congress. You're so important in this. You know, this is a role that we have together. And then the closer we get to a deal, the more tight-lipped the administration is about it, the fewer closed-door hearings they've held with lawmakers, and the more they've made apparent that they want to veto anything that would give Congress a say. So
mm-hmm.
Corker has just said, you know, this is frustration. It's boiling over. I understand it. And I think that's probably going to be the attitude that's going to be pervasive among Democrats who originally supported the bill as well.
Yeah, J.R., what do you think? The this whole idea of you know, going to Congress is obviously part of the Constitution, but what is he going to call an agreement that he makes with Iran? I mean, if it's not going to be a treaty, is it going to be a memorandum of understanding?
Yes.
I mean, they're actually
memorandum of understanding. That's it exactly.
Diplomatic demarches that are specific, and that I think Congress still has the power to scuttle a memorandum of understanding too.
I think so too. Absolutely.
I thought it would have to be both houses of Congress.
He knows damn well that Congress is not going to go for it, okay? So he can't go through Congress, and he has to have this agreement so that he has something to show for in foreign policy. His entire foreign policy otherwise has been an unmitigated disaster from one end to the other. You can blame anything you want on George Bush, but you can't get around the fact that Obama was given a pretty good set of cards, hand of cards by the Bush administration, and he just blew it.
I was going to say, his "I pulled this out of Iraq" thing doesn't work very well now.
Right. That one doesn't really play anymore with all the, you know, rolling heads and people being set on fire and every other kind of thing. So he's got to have this, and that's why he's not going to go to Congress. And, you know, he can basically, this is really his last chance at any kind of a foreign policy triumph. And he's going to grab for it. He's going to keep Congress out of it, and he's going to scuttle out of office, and then claim that whoever replaces him is the person that blew it.
I'm just wondering how could he get away with this. I mean, nobody's asking that question.
Rick, how's he gotten away with everything else?
because nobody has standing to challenge him. And the courts are courts are even reluctant to overturn stuff.
Well, Roberts is obviously scared stiff. There's no question about that. My question about that is where have they got something on him, or is he seriously afraid for the health of the institution, or what?
He doesn't like to be criticized in the New York Times. He doesn't like to be criticized in the New York Times or the Washington Post. All his friends, when he goes to cocktail parties, will avoid him if they say mean things about him.
Right, but it's the same thing. Same thing is true with Congress and so forth. And, you know, Obama owns the bureaucracy. The bureaucracy is all in his corner, and apparently he thinks that's all that he needs. And so far, he's been dead right. He has gotten clean away with it.
But I've been trying to rack my brains for days, weeks, to come up with and I've been alive now for 61 years, and been following politics pretty much for close to 50 years. I have yet to come up with a similar circumstance where a president spends, 2 years negotiating an agreement. Doesn't call it a treaty, doesn't call it anything, and just it's just supposed to have the full effect of law without any say-so on the part of the Senate or Congress at all. I mean, I just don't people point this out anywhere? I've never seen it pointed out. They just say, well, the Republicans are being obstructionists. Well, what are we going to follow the Constitution here? That's my question.
But he's not an American in the sense that he recognizes the Constitution. This is a guy that, as I've pointed out time and again, and for some reason this doesn't take. Nobody pays any attention to it. This is a guy who came to awareness, who grew up in the midst of one of the most rigorous and harsh dictatorships on the face of the earth. That is where he gets his idea of how politics works. He doesn't get his idea from George Washington or Abe Lincoln or even Winston Churchill, for that matter. He gets his ideas from General Mohammed Suharto, which is an individual who most people have no idea in this country, have no idea who he is, but is one of the most corrupt rulers of all time. And a guy who brutally oversaw the execution of somewhere from 300,000 to 500,000 of his fellow Indonesians during the Civil War there. This is where he gets his idea. It's fly-whisk politics. This guy, Barack Obama, and I will repeat this as many times as it takes, thinks that that's what leadership is, and that's what he has a right to do. He doesn't have to go to Congress. He doesn't have to pay attention to the American people. He doesn't have to do anything at all because he is the leader. And his every idea he gets is from this notion of a third world dictatorship. He is not an American president in any meaningful intellectual, political, or social sense.
Well, there's it's certainly not holding him in good stead on foreign relations, because there's a great article, a great op-ed today in Foreign Policy by Robert Gordon, former ambassador to Syria, former deputy ambassador to Iraq during the Bush years, who just came out flat out and said that the president's Syria policy has failed again.
What, he just realized? It just occurred to him this week?
What's amazing is they're preparing now to train these so-called moderate Syrian rebels. But every time they find a militia or a group to train, they switch allegiance to al-Nusra or Islamic State.
Well, you know, compared to ISIS, the al-Qaeda is moderate. So that's not really a meaningful statement.
Yeah. So what we have is no moderates to train an army to fight both Islamic State and President Assad. We have President Assad now openly asking the West to back him, which is interesting when you consider that what was it, the 2 years ago,
right.
Obama said, you know, Assad has got to go.
Assad is still dropping barrel bombs on citizens.
Yeah. He's still using chemical weapons too, but we don't hear about that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
That's the non-news right there.
Yeah, chlorine is not chemical enough for Susan Rice. So.
I guess. No red lines.
It doesn't really completely fit Samantha Power's definition of genocide. So it's okay.
But you not only have Iraq and Syria, you have Afghanistan, where it looks like now we're going to delay the
Yemen.
Yemen, another failed state.
Mm-hmm.
We have what's going on in Lebanon right now is kind of under the radar, but is really getting serious as the Sunnis and the Shias are squaring off again. Looks like another civil war is brewing there. Which, you know, and here's Israel surrounded Syria, Lebanon. Jordan is relatively peaceful, but Islamic State is making inroads there too. Israel is back up against the wall here, and I think that's the major reason Netanyahu came to Washington was to add to my problems by enabling a nuclear Iran.
Yeah, did you see there was a photo tweeted from one of the Kurdish news services today where the Saddam Hussein statue was pulled down in Baghdad after the war? Well, today somebody propped up giant photos of Khomeini and Khamenei along there. Yes. So, great. Just what we need.
Yeah, and of course, all that war has done is now empower the Shias, who are loyal to Iran, and thank Mr. Obama for that also. Thank you, Mr. President. You're making Iran into a regional hegemon.
Yeah, uh-huh. And Human Rights Watch is basically gathering a very rapidly growing catalog of everything that these Shiite militias that are saying that they're out there stopping ISIS are doing to citizens as they kind of rampage across the land there. And it's not pretty, so.
No, they're Sunni territory, and they're massacring Sunnis hundreds at a time, massacring, lining them up and shooting them.
Uh-huh.
I mean, as bad as anything Islamic State is doing.
Goes back to 100 years.
Yeah, at least. The fight over the caliphate, yeah.
The entire point is that we cannot forget that much of this, probably not all of it, but much of it would have been avoided if Barack Obama had taken one move, had kept the United States involved there. But he wouldn't do it. And why didn't he do it? Sheer personal spite. He wanted to humiliate George Bush. Well, back in my day, back in the 60s, we call this karma, man.
Yeah. And with that, we'll have to say goodnight. We've run out of time. Bad karma, man.
It's a bummer, man.
Okay, I want to thank
Rick,
our
good
guest
night.
Tonight,
Bridget
Johnson of PJ Media and Washington editor. Bridget, a nice job as usual. Glad for your insights. We'll call you on again real soon.
Okay. Thanks a lot, guys.
And you, we are done. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you tomorrow on IM. So join me again next week, same time, same place. Bye-bye.